The president was greeted by veteran Soviet ambassador
to offer condolences on the death of Leonid Brezhnev.
The operation is what's crucial, because what we do is for the good of the many. Don't let your conscience get us killed.
This is a West Coast Project podcast for the Americans. My name is Mike, and I'm here with Jamie. Hi, Jamie.
Hi, Mike.
Hey, so we're up to 302 Baggage. So, Jamie, I wanted to ask you about this other show that's like pimping itself all over the place, Allegiance from NBC. Have you ever seen that?
No, I haven't heard of it.
It's a total ripoff of The Americans.
Is it really?
They even advertise on FX, and one of the commercials I saw an advertisement for it. But it's about a family who's spies, and they're worried about their son getting recruited in. I mean, it's a total exact ripoff of The Americans.
Huh. And probably as well done.
I haven't watched it. I probably should watch it before I rip it apart. But just stealing that originality is kind of bullshit.
Yeah, well, I agree. I'll have to check it out. Yeah, you'll have to tell me about things like that. I only watch what I watch. Like, I don't actually, like, watch television. I watch the series that I'm interested in and then nothing else.
Yeah.
So, not even commercials. And so, I the whole television experience is lost on me until somebody tells me, oh, yeah, you should see this thing or that.
I also wanted to thank Amy Davidson, who writes for New Yorker Magazine, because I got a lot of my ideas from comments I want to make about this episode, Baggage. She's, I guess, a political writer for New Yorker. I don't know if you read New Yorker Magazine or have heard of her, Jamie.
I've read some articles from the New Yorker, but no, I don't read it regularly.
She talks about like the motivations of the spies in real life, like why was like Oleg kind of a looking for a reason to, you know, why is he in this game? And then somebody even asked Philip at one point in here, like, who are you? And he's
right,
you know,
right.
He says, I'm here because my people are dying in Afghanistan.
Right, right. Well, yeah, he was talking to Yusuf, and Yusuf has said, who are you? And he said, my people are dying in Afghanistan. That's how he pulled Yusuf in. Yusuf killed Annalise, that's how he pulled him in and started to explain to him what it was he wanted from him. And we didn't hear the rest of the conversation, but we did hear that little piece of it.
Yeah, and I think it's clear now, I forget where we talked about this, but it's pretty clear now that Philip let Yusef kill Annalise to get the one-up over Yusef so he could use him further.
Right. Yeah, yeah. You were saying that after watching this episode this week that that you were pretty convinced that that's exactly what happened, and I agree with you.
Yeah, and then this Amy writes about what motivations would drive a person, like what would you think would drive you to let somebody else die for you to further the cause that you really care about? And that's kind of the answer for Philip is more people of his country are dying in this godforsaken war in Afghanistan. So that's his real motivation.
I guess that's the case. And, you know, in a more specific sense, and in a greater sense, you know, I think it kind of harkens back to the idealism that he holds and the dedication that he has to furthering, his own worldview, what he thinks is the right thing, the right state of being for the world. You know, and that's a big philosophical question. I guess that's one of those after the recap questions that we could discuss later.
Yeah, and that's always what interested me in doing these podcasts. Is wasn't so much a fan cast recap, just scene by scene by scene, what happened, and crack a couple jokes, but the psychology behind it all.
Yeah,
you know, that's why I like that show, The Affair, because it was written with all the psychology layered underneath it. And there's a lot of that in The Americans. So there's a lot of room for commenting on motivations of people.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I'm glad that you agree with that, because I wasn't quite sure, because I think we talked about maybe doing it a little bit differently for season three. But I really think that, that's kind of where. When you've got a show that's written that well as The Americans is written, it just kind of begs you to kind of dig in there and talk about the things that really matter.
So with that said, let's go do a recap.
Okay.
The first scene is Nina's prison cell. Not much to do in that cell, Jamie. Have you ever thought of what you would do in the first 5 minutes if you're ever stuck in a prison cell?
Actually, I have. I have thought about that. And I think that probably for me, the first thing would be trying to figure out how not to panic and sort of size the place up and figure out how I would spend, you know, the next 23 hours or so of each day living in that space. And I think for me, it would be about compartmentalization.
Yeah. And one thing I don't think we get on TV is like what it smells like or what the temperature is. I mean, what if it was just freezing cold and you realize, okay, I'm in here. No heat's going to come. No more blankets are going to come. This is it. Right. And we see Nina's pretty tough. Nina doesn't complain too much. She just kind of sits and accepts it. I don't know how long she's been in there at this point, but we get it. We get a counterpoint to her with another prisoner coming in who does kind of panic at the beginning.
Right. Yeah. And you can see that Nina is very uncomfortable witnessing this prisoner freaking out and crying and having the reaction that she is having.
So next we're going to see the aftermath of Annalise's murder. Philip helps him out. It's pretty clear Philip did do all this to get the upper hand on him. He just gives him a beer and says, I'm here to help you. Then he calls Elizabeth to help. And during that call, we see Chekhov's tooth. What do you think is going to ultimately happen with her tooth or her jaw?
Show the tooth in the first scene. Blood-covered tooth must come out. yeah, I don't know. I think it's good. It's a good bit of realism that we get to see her suffering, that she didn't just get the heck beat out of her and, you know, and then just goes on the next day as though nothing's happened. I'm glad to see that she's, you know, that it's real, that she's really having a hard time. But I don't know what she's going to do because she can't go to the dentist, you know, for at least a month, according to her. They'll be watching.
And they're proving the Chekhov-ness of it by showing it like multiple times too.
Okay. Well, what I'll say about that is that to me, it's just more evidence of very good writing. I think, you know, the people who write this show have done a lot of reading in their past, it seems.
Maybe it'll get shot out accidentally by Martha's Chekhov's gun sometime later.
Okay, she'll get really, really lucky, and that bullet, that magic bullet, will just hit the right exact tooth, and all will be solved.
All right, maybe that's a little too much psychology. So, interestingly, in this scene, Jamie, we hear Paige starting to question her mom about where you know, do you ever ask Dad where he is at night? Like, she's questioning their marriage and the fidelity of Philip to their marriage.
Yeah. I was kind of surprised by that, and I guess that's just another indication that Paige is growing up and that Paige is getting to a place where she is an independent thinker. She doesn't see her parents with that sort of, you know, glassy-eyed idealism, and that's a big step toward adulthood. But it was interesting to me that she is suspicious of her father more so than her mother. But, you know, her mother's manipulating her right now, you know, being involved with her in the church and, you know, they're closer and that kind of thing. So, you know, maybe that's got something to do with it. But yeah, that suspicion about her dad is, I wasn't expecting it. I didn't expect it.
It's important that she's noticing, and her suspicion's going to need to be resolved, I guess, or revealed one way or another pretty soon. She also says something really interesting, Jamie. She says, you guys look out for each other more than us. You look out for one another more than you look out for Henry and me.
Right. Right. That was kind of sad. I mean, hearing her say that, and I think that Elizabeth, you know, had the same reaction. She was just kind of surprised and saddened to hear Paige say it. But Paige was actually, she said it was a good thing. So I think that what Paige is thinking is, you know, if you and Dad are close, if you're that close, then it's actually a good thing, even though we aren't first.
Do you think it's true?
Well, in a way, it kind of has to be true. By necessity, they have to, because the nature of their jobs, the nature of their lives, they have to be there for each other 100%. Nothing else can come first, you know, including their kids.
Yeah, I don't know what I think yet. I don't know if it's true or not, but I think that's one of the driving questions that makes this show pretty cool to watch. What is their ultimate motivation going to be? The country, the cause, the kids, their own safety?
Well, I think that, yeah, I mean, I think there's some really basic questions. You could get into, you know, kind of Maslow's hierarchy of needs here and you know, and talk about what a human being's basic needs are. And then beyond that, what is important? And that's a good question. Because, you know, the kinds of people that this story is about, people who are spies, people who are double agents, people who are willing to die for a cause that they believe in, are people who have a different set of priorities than most human beings.
Yeah. So back in the series here, we see Philip coaching Youssef how to act to the death of this wife of a Pentagon official, Annalise. Can't just pretend he doesn't know about it. He has to kind of act normal. And this is where we see Youssef ask, "Who are you?" And that whole cool Amy Davidson thing on, you know, "I'm here because my people are dying in Afghanistan." It's a pretty powerful reason to be motivated. I think Philip sets that pretty clearly here. I mean, that answers a lot of the evil things that he does and excuses. Like this death of Annalise, pretty brutal for him to just let it happen, but that's why he's letting all this happen.
Yeah, and that's such an existential question, that question about whether, you know, it's a better idea to, what is one human life worth less or more than another human life? And, you know, if there are many, many human lives, are those collectively worth more than one? And, you know, his answer, Philip's answer is yes. I mean, a collective number of lives are worth more than one life, one single life, at least in this case.
That's very subjective, too. Like, my brother's life is more important than your brother's life to me. Mm-hmm. You know, I think that's just human. But anyway, it's pretty cool that they lay this out right in the very beginning.
Yeah, I agree with you. But that's, you know, you and I talked a little bit about motivations, at least regarding Elizabeth. Like, I think it was last podcast we talked about that, and I told you that I thought that we would get a lot more into Elizabeth's motivations and her reasoning and her thinking and that kind of thing. But it seems almost like my prediction was kind of flipped on its head, because what we're seeing so much more of is all of the other characters except for her. we're seeing what's really inside Stan's head, what's really inside Philip's head, and so on. So, but it's fascinating.
Well, the next scene, Jamie, I thought was teeing me up for a massive joke, but it turns out they stole my punchline. They stole my thunder. That was the box version of Varys. I thought that was going to be an awesome joke I'd be able to tell in this podcast. But they wheel this crate in, and I was going to make a joke about a person being inside it. But it turns out, Jamie, there really is a girl inside it. It's the mail order girl for Stan.
Yeah, I was thinking the same thing. When they were rolling that box in there, I was like, there's somebody in there. There can't be somebody in there. There was somebody in there. and I think that the reveal there, we were sort of expected to think that maybe and hope that maybe it was Nina.
Oh, I didn't think about Nina, but I didn't think it was a person. That's why it was going to be funny, but turns out it was the Canadian embassy woman. But my reference, of course, is Varys and Tyrion in Game of Thrones, where Varys has the dude that tortured him in the trunk shipped into where.
Oh, that's right. Yep. And then Tyrion, of course, at the last scene of the last episode was himself in a box. He was delivered to the ship in a box.
That's right.
Yeah, to make his escape.
But so we don't really know what's in the box. What's in the box at this point? We do get a packing lesson, though, from Philip and Elizabeth. And Jamie, I turned the sound down on this one. And on the rewatch, I fast-forwarded it. So I have not heard the full sound effects of this putting Annalise into the suitcase.
Oh, you're so lucky, because I will never get it out of my head. It was awful.
Philip calls Elizabeth for backup, and she, because he has more items to move or something, was his code for it. But she brings a suitcase, and they have to move Annalise out of the hotel room. Now, Jamie, do you think that was necessary anytime you pack a body into a bag like that, or do you think it was rigor mortis?
Oh, no. They were cracking her her elbows opposite their normal bend. So, no, they needed to break some joints and some bones in order to fit her properly into that suitcase.
That was brutal.
It was brutal.
Was worse than the visual of it.
Yeah, it was. It was.
All right, so we go to Nina's cell. Now she has a roommate, her cellmate, Evie from Belgium, shows up. Nina doesn't like roommates, though. She shuts her down, doesn't even want to talk to her.
I wondered about that, because there's a part, I don't know if you remember seeing it, but when Evie's, her name's Evie?
Yeah, Evie.
Okay, so when Evie's talking to her, when she's talking to Nina, she's asking Nina questions, and she's saying, I'm innocent, and, you know, Nina's kind of like, she lays down on the bed and turns her back to Evie, and then you see a close-up of the wall or the ceiling, and there's a fine wire that's painted over, but you can definitely see there's a wire, and it's coiled at one part, and then it twists, and it's like stuck to the wall or the ceiling or whatever that is. And I think that Nina knows that everything that she says is certainly recorded, that somebody's hearing every bit of conversation that she has in that cell. And I think that maybe Nina is suspicious of Evie, and at the very least, Nina doesn't want to say anything to further incriminate herself.
Wow, thank you for that. I totally missed that. I thought that was just some scratching on the wall, like the number of days somebody else had been in there or something.
Yeah, I don't know. I saw wire there, so I have to assume, because it's the Americans and it's such a smart show, that they're showing us something for a reason.
Yeah, that makes total sense, though. That's great.
Yeah.
So next, Elizabeth and Philip take the body away, and Yusuf looks really weak. Yusuf is not in that same class as these people as far as tough spy, counter spy. He's just kind of shaken by all this and looks really weak.
Well, that bastard, he can look weak, and he can be weak, and he can feel weak. I hope he meets an end similar to the one that he doled out to Annalise. I don't have any sympathy for him, so I hope he's suffering every day and every night.
So the girl in the box is Zenaida Probarzyjanskaya.
Wow, excellent.
I'll just spell her last name so you can see what I'm up against here. Probarzyjanskaya. I'm going to call her Zen, Zenaida. Let's call her Zen for ease of comfort of getting through this. And the actress is Svetlana Efremova. She's
yeah.
got an F, an R, and an M together, so I don't know how you pull that off, but Svetlana. and Stan's meeting her and trying to make a reservation, not meeting her, but setting her up for her stay in the U.S. And he's trying to make a reservation at a in a hotel with a room that's kind of off the main track. And right. She's spazzing out over these Milky Way bars. What did you think of that?
Well, I mean, that just is another reminder of how bleak life is in the Soviet Union. They can't even get decent candy. She bites it and almost has an epiphany. It's a, you know, it's a moment of glory, hallelujah for her. You know, Milky Way, what can you say?
I'm afraid she's going to like those Milky Ways too much.
She'll end up needing a dentist. Maybe then we can slip Elizabeth in there.
Yeah, that's true. Dentists could be important. So she worked for an institute in Moscow that reported to the Soviet leadership on the political significance of whatever the U.S. and Canada were doing. So, Jamie, I thought it was interesting here. They make these counterpoints all the time in this show, which I think are really cool. But one character is being introduced to the expanse and luxury of the American way of life. And right after, we just saw Evie being introduced to this restriction and horror of the Soviet prison cell.
Right.
I love that contrast. Whether Evie's a plant or not, we see the fear in one and kind of the wide wide-eyed, open wonder of the other.
Well, isn't that interesting? Because you know, we've talked about this before, how this show uses mirroring and to illustrate points and to create metaphor for the audience, and that's just another example of that wonderful contrast that they provide. It just makes the story feel deeper and sort of takes you. It gives you something else to think about and to sort of ruminate over, chew on, you know, even beyond the story that's been presented.
I think it makes you think about it even if you don't know that you're thinking about it. Like, even if you don't realize, prison cell, nothing to do, total misery, and great, you know, benefits of America, total freedom and everything. Whether right. that's conscious to you or not, you think about it.
Yeah, I think you're right.
Then we see Elizabeth with her mother way back in the day, and Elizabeth's name too. Her real name is also very hard to pronounce, Nadezda.
Yeah, something like that.
I'll spell it too: Nadezhda, Nadezda.
Yeah. I've heard them pronounce it so many times on the show, and I still can't say it. So I'm not even going to.
I'm going to keep calling her Elizabeth. found out her mother didn't like her father. She wouldn't go to his memorial at the time of the flashback because he was a deserter. He was shot for being a deserter.
That's not a new bit of story. That I believe it was in the pilot, we saw a scene between Elizabeth and her mom where some sort of government guy, some sort of someone who had something to give, maybe not government, could have just been some sort of middle class guy, showed up at their home and made an offer to them of like food and clothing or something, and the mother refused it. And Elizabeth couldn't understand why her mother refused it. And after the guy left, her mother said, you know, something like, nothing is free. He would have wanted us to pay him for what he was going to give us in some kind of way. And it was really interesting because she was young when her mother was telling her this. And you could tell it was just kind of one of those moments that a young child starts to see a bit more of the actual world the way it is. They kind of lose that innocence. It was one of those moments.
I still think this is why Elizabeth was pushed into this service. I mean, maybe not directly, but psychologically by this mother figure to Elizabeth was a huge influence, probably the biggest influence in her life. I think more than Philip.
Elizabeth's real mom?
Yeah.
I think you're right. And, you know, just having this conversation right now and hearing you say exactly what you just said kind of pushed me in that direction in my thinking because, you know, I'm telling you this story about that happened, I think it was in the pilot episode, and then we have this flashback now in this episode, and then Elizabeth says what she says at the end of this episode, and we can talk about it when we get to that scene, but it's very revealing, I think.
Yeah, I liked also how in this scene that mom, she says mom in Russian. Mom is the same everywhere. You know, it's probably the same in a lot of languages, something similar to that sound. It's just such a powerful basic need and a connection, your mother, you know, your powerful influence of your mother.
Yeah, you're right.
Back in real time, Elizabeth's kind of thinking about her mother in that scene with the blue dress. I don't know why she thought of the blue dress, but she mentioned it, kind of referred to it as the blue dress.
Right. And I think that certainly we'll see something that has some significance, you know, to that reference again, because it just, you know, again, the writing on this show is just so good. They wouldn't mention something that specific unless it had some sort of meaning, even if it's only just for us to have in our minds the knowledge that Elizabeth is really thinking a lot about her mom.
So we're going to see Zenaida do her press conference now. And again, this is kind of hammered in by that Amy Davidson article. So Zenaida's doing this press conference, and her argument and basic philosophical struggle is the Soviets can decide other people's leadership, the Afghan leadership. And that's pretty true even today. Like, now we're deciding all these other countries' leadership. it's pretty interesting how that was important. That was more important in this context of Zinaida and talking to Stan about this press conference. They were talking about Brezhnev's death too, and that was just a minimal plot point. That had really nothing to do with this episode. The whole point was the whole Politburo was behind this Afghanistan war and changing the way this whole country of other people are going to be run, just because that was the way that the Soviets wanted to see it.
Right. Well, I mean, certainly that's true of every country that's a major world power ever, you know, in the history of world, you know, every country that's ever been powerful and has sought to control the fate of another, you know, that they've gone in and done that, and they've made the assumption, and that's what power does. That's, you know, when you have power, you do that. And, you know, it's people like this character and like, you know, other people who are idealistic people, you know, who stand up and say, no, that's not right. And oftentimes, you know, spend their lives or lose their lives in defending, you know, people that they'll never see and, you know, never know, and, you know, for the sake of an idea, you know, and that, again, that we return to that theme here, because that's what this is. That's what this is about. The idea of, you know, of Elizabeth and Philip being here and sacrificing every choice that they ever could have had, you know, that they're doing this for the sake of something that they really believe in, you know, and yet on the other side, there are people who are, you know, just as devoted, you know, to, you know, there, to whatever it is that's precious to them, and they're willing to sacrifice as much as that or more, you know, for that. And it's just, thinking about it is exhausting in a way.
Yeah, I guess plug in your time frame and you see samples of it anywhere throughout history.
Yeah.
So Philip meets with Yusuf at the pool, and they're talking about Annalise a little bit more, which is interesting. They put in like this little setting of Annalise and how Yusuf remembered her personality and her humanity, how she spoke different languages. And there was a person behind that functioning body that got used for certain things. That was a real person there.
Right. Yeah. And I'm glad that that Philip and Yusuf remembered her fondly. I think that was a crucial scene, actually, because of the way that she was dispatched. I think that it could have.
Baggage.
Yeah. I mean, it just, you know, it was just such an awful, awful, awful scene, such an awful way to handle, you know, the end of a person's life. I think that they were obligated, you know, and I mean that in terms of the story. I mean that in terms of the writers, that they had to at least, you know, put some humanity in there attached to both of these characters, because otherwise, what they did is, it's monstrous regardless, but in the absence of them remembering her as a human being, it would have been so much worse.
It's pretty cool how they used the personality, the person behind Annalise, to like focus on that to also show that Yusuf is weak. He's uncertain in his role. He's not really a very good soldier. He's not like a Philip soldier. And I think because of this, he's going to be a goner, Jamie. I think he's going to be short-lived in this series.
But
it serves the plot in that Philip, thinking that he's weak, needs those contacts before he, like, surrenders or kills himself, or, you know, the time frame for getting the contacts from Yusuf is now important because of his weakness, I think.
Yeah, well, yeah. I mean, I don't think he'll stick along. He'll stick around for a very long time. You know, I personally hope that he jumps off a bridge, but that's just me being, you know, a sympathetic person. I think he's awful, and I think he's only there for a purpose, and then he'll be gone. He doesn't seem to be written to be a character who's got any staying power.
I like how the writers are tying up some of our plot points too as we go along, because we're going to see Stan get kind of shanghaied here by Oleg in the alley. And they start to trade thoughts about Nina. Oleg doesn't want to hear anything at all about how Stan loved her.
Right.
Jamie, why do you think Oleg didn't just shoot him?
Well, I think that part of that was self-preservation. I think that part of it was that maybe he's not a murderer. Maybe he's not a killer. You know, he's a diplomat. He's a you know, a government employee. He's a privileged person. And privileged people aren't normally killers. And, you know, I think that he would like to have been able to kill Stan, but I don't think he ever really thought he would. I don't think that he really believed in his own mind that he would. But I have to say that that scene was just awful. And, you know, partly because I've sort of become fond of Oleg.
I thought you were fond of Stan. I thought you were going to say.
Oh, I'm very fond of Stan. I love Stan. But, you know, this scene was so interesting because, you know, I've spent, you know, a season or more, you know, purposely not looking at the ugliness that Stan has done because he's done some awful things. He broke up his own family. He was morally just absolutely he had no ground to stand on as far as his behavior has gone. And I've not looked at it because I like the story guy. You know, I like the actor. I like, you know, the character, the way that he's written when he's not cheating on his wife. And so I excused him. But I still like him. But in that alley, his chickens came home to roost. I mean, his fate that he actually earned was awaiting him. And if Oleg had shot him, he would have earned that bullet. Because what he did wasn't just wrong. It was bad. Like, what he did ended up having consequences that just went so far beyond ruining the life of his son, ruining his marriage and the life of his wife, and you know, and all the ripples that sort of went out from that action that he chose. You know, it wasn't just that. I mean, you know, look at what's happening with Nina, and you know, and look at what's happening with Oleg. And in a way, Oleg's broken heart is Stan's fault. You know. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, so looking at that and seeing that scene in the alley, it was a tough moment. I didn't want Stan to die, and I was really sad. And the time he was walking away from Oleg, and he said, "You're just gonna, you know, what did he say? Screw you, Oleg. You know, if you want to shoot me, you're gonna have to shoot me in the back." And he starts walking away from him, and every single step, I was on the end of my seat just going, no, please, no, 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 don't die, Stan, no, don't. But I have to say, I felt something really strongly about Oleg in that scene. I mean, you saw the depth of his love for Nina, and you saw how brokenhearted he was, and how could you not feel something for him?
To me, it made Stan and Oleg look like total equals. Like, if this was a Stratego game and they encountered each other, no one would have won. You know, no one would have been taken off the board. It was like total equal.
Wow.
They're both bishops or whatever. They're equal. But Stan's courage is a front. He's really shaken by this. He gets out of it, but he really needs to reach out and get some human touch pretty soon to comfort him.
Right.
And we'll see that in a second.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm glad you said something because I was going to ask you about that.
But in between that and now, Elizabeth's got more tooth pain, and like you said, it's actually bleeding. That can't be good.
Right.
So she and Philip discuss this list of people of the Afghan group, and Philip, and this connected all to Yusef. Philip wants a team to do it, and Hans isn't ready, the guy that was being trained by Elizabeth to follow her in the car. And she's actually mad. Elizabeth is mad with Philip that he put Annalise together with Yusef instead of her. And then this turns all into a discussion about Paige becoming like Elizabeth, Paige becoming maybe like Annalise. Anything connected to any of that is like not good for thinking of your daughter eventually someday being put in a suitcase or having to sleep with someone or having to kill people. All of it just is so negative.
And isn't it interesting the way that that conversation developed? Because it's exactly the way that you and I were thinking, of Elizabeth and Philip. That Elizabeth and her idealism and her pragmatism and the way that she thinks about the world, and you know, she's so realistic while being like the ultimate ideologue. She's very, very invested in the world the way that she sees it, and she's willing to do whatever it takes, even more so than Philip. And the odious, the awful, the just heartrending things that Philip has done, for example, allowing Annalise to die, that kind of stuff that Philip has done, even to the extent that he's that extreme in his views about the world, that he would let someone die like that for a different cause, he's still not as extreme as Elizabeth is. And we see that illustrated in that scene between them, because she is just determined. She says, you know, what do you want, for life to be perfect? And, you know, and he says, yes, for my daughter, yes.
Yeah, my daughter's, you know, different.
Yeah, and she doesn't think so.
All right, so this next scene was a tough one for me, Jamie. This Stan reaching out to first his son, then his wife, and then his wife's new boyfriend.
Right.
This was a tough scene as a guy for me. I've reached out for somebody, anybody, at times in my life before. Never because of a close death call, but just for reasons where you just want to connect with somebody. So Stan leaves a message for his son, Matthew, from this cold-ass phone booth, too, outside. It was just a really cool scene. Then Sandra... And then even Arthur, her new squeeze, I guess, or I don't know if she's married. She must be married because they're living together, don't you think?
Well, I don't know, because she said, last season she said, when she told Stan that she was leaving him, she told him, I'm moving in with him. She didn't say she was marrying him.
Okay.
So I think they could be only living together.
Okay. But he just stretches out this phone call. He doesn't want to hang up. The hang up is brutal. But he just needs a lifeline, right? He just needs a touch of humanity here to help settle him after this brush with death.
Right, and it's so tragic. I'm glad to hear that it was hard for you to watch that, because it was awful for me to watch. I couldn't stand it to see him so alone and so brokenhearted. The only thing that made it a little bit bearable is because he totally, totally put this all on himself. I mean, he created this. And so, you know, I can think about that instead of crying, which is what it made me want to do. I wanted to cry when I saw this scene. But it's just so human. And that's what I think was really, really cool about actually the first two episodes of this season. They have been so, I want to say, like almost hyper emotional in a way. That's just, and not in the touchy-feely kind. This world that these characters are inhabiting this season is a very dark, very dangerous, very frightening place.
Yeah, you're right. It's literally dark in a lot of these scenes at night and stuff.
Yeah.
And cold. It's like cold in the cells in the rainy, cold, wintry-looking weather of D.C.,
right, yeah.
But for Stan, this call wasn't enough. He actually goes to the Arthur-Sandra house. And Arthur, this guy Arthur's pretty civil. I'm not sure what I would have done either as Stan or Arthur. But Arthur pulls off the high road here pretty well, I think.
Yeah, yeah.
Jamie, have you ever been in this situation where you're kind of overly proximate with an ex or the boyfriend of an ex or girlfriend or whatever, or parent or somebody? Have you ever found yourself like that?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, sure. Certainly. I thought it was written well. I thought it was played well, because I thought that the words that Sandra spoke were very true words when she said, you know, that's all I have for you. That's all I have.
Yeah. He tells her about what happened and she rejects him. She listens to him, but rejects him.
Yeah.
And she asks him a couple times why he came. I don't know if she's looking just for her own edification and the answer of what happened between you and me, clarification. But Stan tells her that seeing her makes him feel alive, and she's the only person he wanted to tell. Well, first he says death. Some people say death makes you feel alive, but you're the only person I wanted to tell about this. And then she asks why again, and he just says, I don't know, which prompts her to say, I'm not coming back. This, you're coming close to death doesn't give you a get-me-back-free card. Mm-hmm. But I got to give Sandra some credit and criticism here. She's pretty mean to him. She shuts him down, but it also prevents any false hope that Stan might walk away from this with.
Okay, so I'm in this scene between Stan and Sandra. As much sympathy as I always have for Stan, I'm really with Sandra in this scene. I identify with her. I understand her. And the thoughts that she was expressing are thoughts that were just naturally forming in my mind as this scene unfolded between the two of them. She cares about him. She was in love with him. She was devoted to him. She was married to him. And through no fault of hers, and against all of her efforts, that marriage fell apart because he wasn't in it. And he threw it away at the end. And so as much as she cares about him and she's glad that he's alive, that's all she's got to give him. And he needs so much more. I mean, he's there. And if she would have said to him, I'll come back, if she had said anything to him, he would have taken whatever she had to give. But she wasn't going to give him anything.
It's a tricky line. Like, when do you just offer help to someone, even if you're not going to go back to them? Just offer, like, kindness and a shoulder. And when do you just simply remain honest? If you're offering them help and letting them tell their story and, like, oh, I really feel for you, and she hugs him and she doesn't do anything else, it kind of implies, like, there's a little window open there. But if she's just brutally cold and honest, that's good, too, but it doesn't really help Stan with these feelings he has.
Right.
It's a pretty fine line to toe, I think.
I think that the way that they wrote it and the way that the actors acted it, it was really, really well done, because Stan needs to feel this. He needs to feel that aloneness and the regret of his choices and the finality of what he's done.
Man, cold-hearted woman.
Which one?
I'm talking about you.
If you only knew, you know I'm mushy.
All right, well, let's listen to Elizabeth. Listen to her mother. By the way, I didn't say, I'm really glad we got to see Elizabeth's mother. I forgot about the pilot the first time in the pilot. I'm really glad we got to see her this time with Elizabeth as a little girl again. A little bit more enlightening.
Yeah.
And I still say she's the most powerful force in her life. And Philip offers up, I guess they're in their little secret room in the behind the fuse box in the basement. Uh-huh. But Philip offers her to go see her. They're travel agents. That's their business. You know, they can pull that off. And then he makes a statement, Jamie. He says, they owe you that. He refers to his team in the third person. They, not we owe you that.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think that I think that's fair, because I think he's thinking of you know, the center. I think he's thinking about Russia as opposed to satellite office, you know, out here in the suburbs of D.C. But I get that. But I think anybody would think that way. I think anybody would just, you know, if it were me and my spouse were talking about, you know, their job and they needed to travel somewhere for some reason, I would say, even if it was my company, I would say they owe you that, because it's the powers that be. It's the people who decide, who can say yay or nay to a request of that sort that you're thinking of.
So offline, Jamie, you had made a comment to me about let's not confuse the CIA and the FBI.
Right.
We see it here. But first of all, why is Gad still wearing this comical bandage on his nose?
Oh.
How much time has passed since Elizabeth decked him?
I don't think much time has passed, because maybe a day, because we just disposed of Annalise's body, right? And we just got the drawing, the sketches of Elizabeth, and that has to happen fairly quickly. So I'm saying a day.
So like the next day from it?
Yeah, I think so.
But Gad is looking just, he's comic relief, man.
Yeah.
They look at those drawings of Elizabeth, and they do look pretty close to what she looked like in her disguise. But we do see that you were right. The CIA, Jamie, does not like the FBI. They are disdainful of each other, and they don't help each other.
Yeah, and that's kind of a famous division, in American folklore, I guess you could say. It's kind of a common thing there that the CIA and the FBI don't get along. But I don't know why it is that I had convinced myself that Stan worked for the CIA. I guess because the way I see him and the way that I saw and understand the work that the CIA does versus the FBI, because I think of, you know, the FBI as being more into like really like direct crime, just like, you know, several steps above your actual municipal police force. That's how I think of the FBI, but they're bigger than that.
I think isn't the FBI older? We should research this and get it straight, but I would say the FBI is older, like back in the Hoover days, Edgar Hoover's. And the Untouchables and all that. And I think the CIA is more of a spy organization, like maybe born out of World War II.
Yeah, I'm not sure, but I'm about to look it up and see. And I'll do some reading while we're talking and see what we're talking about. Because, you could be right, and I'm not sure. I'm just really not sure.
So maybe the CIA thought of their status is like more elite, like you guys are the old super police FBI, we're the new cool super status CIA. But anyway, that whole relationship is pretty interesting, that they don't even really cooperate.
Yeah, no, they don't. And the FBI is more domestic and the CIA is like worldwide, and I think that's why there's kind of a thing, like the FBI really is elite, but they're not seen as elite in comparison to CIA. And so maybe they just get kind of that step sibling kind of.
CIA feels like they're more important and elite. Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. So next we're going to see Elizabeth and Gabriel talk about Elizabeth's mother. And I guess Gabriel and the mother were kind of contemporaries. They were about the same age and knew each other.
Right.
But Jamie, she aged well, is not a question you would normally expect a daughter to ask about her mother. She aged well, I guess, right? That's so odd to hear her ask that about her own mother.
Well, I don't think that she would have asked if Gabriel hadn't said, "Your mother's so beautiful. She's very beautiful." I think he said, "She's still beautiful." And that's when Elizabeth said she aged well. And he said, "Yes." And so it was more of a kind of continuing a bit of question as attached to the comment that he made. So I don't think that she would have asked otherwise. But I can't imagine that she wouldn't want to know what her mom looks like. And we're finding out just, you know, as a result of this conversation, that she hasn't seen a picture of her mom.
Yeah, that implication of time passing. She hasn't seen her so long that she can't even imagine how she's aged.
Yeah, it's just... It's just so sad. It's just so tragic to think of, you know, that this woman, I mean, you know, and in that way, because I have always found Elizabeth to be somebody that's difficult to like, but it seems to me that, you know, as we get to know her, you know, and we get to understand like what she's really made of, you can't help but have a little bit of heart for her, you know? You know, we were talking about in the last podcast about her doing that soak in the tub. And I didn't think of it at the time. I forgot to mention to you the first thing she does when we see her soaking in the tub, she's got her wristwatch right there. In her hand, she looks at it to make sure what time it is, then puts it down very perfunctorily. And that's, like, to me, that's telling me, like, even this soak in the tub that I'm going to take where I remember something awful that I did to my daughter, I still have to time it because that's who I am. I'm Elizabeth, and I do everything the hard way, you know, kind of thing.
Like the bath is only 4 minutes and that's it.
Exactly.
Well, Gabriel's manipulative. Gabriel's a bad heavy. He's a heavy in this. I think he's going to be an evil person. He manipulates Elizabeth here. He says how Elizabeth's mother and him lost, their generation lost everything in the war, and how Elizabeth's mother is so grateful that her daughter is making a difference in the world. He's just solidifying Elizabeth's place in all this.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I'm going to take your lead on that because I haven't been able to sort of pick up any kind of, to me, he seems like such a benign character at this point. I'm not picking up this, the feeling of foreboding that you're getting from him. But if I know this show, I know that there's something really deep beyond the surface with this guy. I can't pick it up yet.
He's
like, I don't.
He's Dracula, man. Frank Langella.
Do you really think?
Well, that's what he played before.
Oh, okay. Well, then there you go.
he also makes a comment, you and Philip seem different. And they do seem different to me, too. Jamie, I don't know when I had a comment somewhere in my massive notes here, but I made a note to ask you about that. But Elizabeth even answers, well, we are different. Yeah. And then she tells Gabriel about Paige thinking that they had the affair, or Paige thinks Philip's cheating on her.
Right. And it's interesting to me that she feels so able to discuss really extremely personal things with this man, because we don't see Elizabeth doing that with anyone, not Claudia, not even before she hated Claudia, like no one. She doesn't share her thoughts except for with Philip. You know, she doesn't, because you don't even hear her ever record anything to her mom. So we don't hear Elizabeth open up to anyone.
Maybe Gabriel was connected to her mother some way, some romantic way. Like she lived under Gabriel and her mother as a child.
Maybe.
All right. Back in Moscow, Nina and Evie are getting along a little better. We still don't know what Evie did or does. But we find out she doesn't know how long she's in for, or if her embassy even knows. And if that were to be true, that would just be horrible. You're stuck somewhere. You don't even know what you're being prosecuted for, or if your home base people know that you're even in there.
Yeah, I mean, it's just you can imagine why someone would be crying if that were their circumstance. But I wonder if that's the real story.
Yeah, your comment about the bug and the wire now have me feeling less sorry for Evie, because that would make sense that she's a plant.
Yeah, I don't know. It just seems to me like that could be, like it really could be the case. So
Philip and Elizabeth discuss this caper at the hotel where they're going to get Yusef's connections, contacts, that he's been kind of casing this hotel. And I find out, too, Jamie, they have a secret laundry room knock in their own house. When they're in that room, they lock the door, and there's a secret knock.
Oh, gosh. I didn't notice that.
And they look at Philip's recon photos of the hotel, and he kind of describes the setup. They're going to be in different locations at the hotel. And right. Yusef's going to bring his contacts there so they can get the pictures of the faces and the license plates, and so they can figure out who the people are. Mm-hmm. But, Jamie, this distance that that Gabriel hinted at, that they seem different. What is this distance? There's distance between them in this room. They're not friendly or affectionate. What do you sense is that?
Philip is angry with her. This thing about Paige has put a wedge between them. They were close. And so I don't know where Gabriel's perspective is, because certainly they're different, but they're different. They're different last season than they were first season, and they're different now than they were last season. Last season they were very much in love and they were very close, and there was a kind of an openness between them. But I believe that that has been quashed by this huge issue that's going on. They're fighting really for the life of their child, and that's a big fight to have.
So right after this little scene in the laundry room, I guess it is, with this door and the secret knock, they go to the kitchen and they make some pretty cool observations about Paige, or we see Paige and we can make these observations. She's talking about the government cutting back on funding for college, and Philip makes a comment about her reading the paper, like that seemed like grown up. And it seems to me, Jamie, Elizabeth might be pushing her too hard to grow up too fast, but is maybe Philip pushing her too little or stopping her from growing up? Are you really going to be surprised as a parent that your 14-year-old is reading the newspaper?
Well, I don't know. I think that that Philip might be surprised, because Philip is not super involved with the kids lately. And so, you know, that's one thing. You know, he's out busy being, you know, a bigamist and a whole bunch of other things. And so, you know, he doesn't have a lot of time at home. And so that's, I think, you know, a legitimate reason to not know and not recognize things. But dads, with their daughters, for dads, their daughters never really grow up. That's kind of an archetypal sort of a thing, you know, in writing and in fiction and that sort of thing. That dads are, those are always their baby girls, their little girls. And so certainly I think that there's a part of that at play for Philip. And I think that there's a part of him that doesn't want her to grow up, and there's a part of him that truly doesn't realize that she is getting older, that she's getting to be a grown up.
It's funny that you mentioned the word bigamist. I can't remember if it was Amy's article or Alan Sepinwall's about where is Philip being a bigger bigamist with Elizabeth against Martha, or with Martha against Elizabeth? Because he's technically married to Martha.
Right. I don't know. That gets into like, you know, if you're going to talk about bureaucracy and, you know, official paperwork versus reality and, you know, what goes on in your heart.
Yeah, we don't see Martha in this episode that I can recall. But
we didn't see her, and I was looking for her. I wanted to see if she was going to interact with Stan.
She's at the range getting more practice with that ladysmith.
She's out.
She's going to come out blasting soon. All right. Well, so let's go to the hotel. The two vantage points for Elizabeth and Philip are she's there just to see from a different angle, I guess. I don't think she was there to be like a hooker to take someone in that room, was she? She looked like a hooker.
No.
Well, don't worry. I'm going to criticize Philip, too, with his porn stash and his sunglasses. You would look relatively conspicuous with that look at night, I think. He looked like a DJ, didn't he? Like a 70s DJ.
He really did. He really did. I have to say, he's looking kind of schmexy with the porn stash and the sunshades.
Yeah. So they get there. The guy shows up to Yusef's room, and he just kind of makes a quick handshake, and then he leaves, and Elizabeth follows him. She's driven now by this lost list that she had in her hands at one point. She's motivated to get back to that level where she thinks she messed up.
Well, I mean, that's her, right? Like, Elizabeth is not going to – nothing bad's going to happen on her watch. She's going to make sure the job gets done. Like, that girl is about the job.
Well, it's a pretty big risk. That wasn't part of their plan. She's going by her own script.
Well, okay. So, like, I'm with you 100% on that. But I'm saying, like, Philip's known this girl for quite a while. He should have expected she was going to pull something, because that's what she does. She gets the job done.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, this was a commercial break, by the way, where they advertised this freaking Allegiance show. This soulless, brazen theft of originality. But I guess FX took the commercial money from NBC to do it, so.
Yeah, well, yeah, what are you going to do? You know, maybe FX feels like, hey, these people cannot compete, so why not take their money?
It's a joke. It's got to be a joke. I mean, I shouldn't criticize it without seeing it, but the whole premise just seems like, make up something else that's good. Why copy exactly what somebody else is already doing?
It's really weird. That's kind of weird. I almost feel now that I must check it out.
It'd be bad enough if FX did it. Like, okay, this one's good. Let's do this one with the same thing, mirroring it. But it's a different network.
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't know the intimacies between FX and NBC. Maybe they own part of each other or something. But
I don't know. That'd be even worse if that were the case.
So Yusef and the dude that visit him at the motel go to Cooper's Bar, and they meet other people. And it's a pretty good strategy of leaving watchful eyes behind Jamie, of meeting at one place and then going to another meeting. Pretty like putting in a middle step in between.
Yeah, I mean, it really does make it, you know, a lot harder to get caught. But then, of course, we're dealing with, you know, Elizabeth and Philip here, so they were able to manage the, you know, the slip and overcome it and get there and get their photos and everything else. I thought, you know, that was them at their best. And Philip has just turned into, he kind of seemed a little bit like a jerk, you know, the way he was talking to Elizabeth. And, you know, it's the coldness that's between them, because he's angry with her right now. He feels like he can't trust her. But gosh, it just, oh, the way he sounded when he talked to her, and said the thing about, you know, that she should get her teeth fixed, the way that he said it. And then when he said, we should do this more often, he just sounded so just really out there cavalier and just kind of like really like a jerk, like a real jerk, like somebody I wouldn't want to talk to.
Did you notice that all the beers that waitress rattled off were from NATO countries?
No, I didn't.
I'm just kidding. I don't know if they were.
Oh, that would have been so amazing.
But Philip takes some sly pictures of license plates and people kind of behind the back, under the arm. Cool little pic camera he had. And I guess it was the CIA people at that table with Yusef.
Yeah, that's right.
And Yusef's plot to keep going is that all their money is going to radical religious factions, and if they want to support the more moderate factions, they need to have him on their team to help them do that. So that's his angle.
Okay.
And now we see Oleg watching news of Reagan visiting the Soviet Union for Brezhnev's funeral. And I thought it was interesting here, the layer of all these superficial things happening, like the highest level of leaders are meeting to express friendship and sadness at each other's passing, while all their subordinates are slugging it out in the spy game.
Well, yeah, and isn't that the case? I mean, when you have a head of state going anywhere to do friendship things for anybody, that's just, yeah, it's more schmooze, you know? I mean, think of it. Think about, you know, on a smaller level, you know, if you have any sort of, you know, even a municipal, you know, government official showing up somewhere, you know, to be supportive of someone's, you know, whatever it is they're going through, that doesn't mean that their direct subordinate is, you know, feeling anything even near whatever it is that the official is expressing.
Our viewpoint of this is Oleg watching it, I guess, and Tatiana slides up to him during this viewing. Jamie, are they a potential unit, Oleg and Tatiana?
I hope the hell not, because I don't think she's cute, and I don't like her, and I really hope not. I hope that Oleg just kind of, you know, just continues to be in love with Nina, and hopefully we'll get Nina back. But yeah, you're right. I mean, it looks like it. It looks like there's a possibility there. But I think that if anything happens between them, it's going to be perfunctory and kind of like, you know, as a placeholder kind of thing. I don't think he'll have feelings for her.
So they talk about Zenaida going on to meet the media. She's going on literally meet the press and seeing Newsweek and stuff. That's pretty bad news for the Russian cause in Afghanistan. And Tatiana makes the comment that propaganda is more important than anything.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And she, Zenaida's story to the world is that she decided to leave for one reason. The army was creating so much suffering for the people of Afghanistan. The Russian army was creating suffering for another country.
Do you think that there was some sort of double entendre with what Tatiana said when she said the thing about, I wanted to show you that propaganda is the most important thing? It just seems to me like there was something underneath that. Like she didn't only mean the surface comment.
What was the subtext, do you think?
I don't know. I was thinking, I don't know if she's trying to tell him something about what happened with him and Nina, if she knows anything like that, or if she has some other agenda that's related to their work. I don't know.
Like you and I should be together, Oleg, so that we look a certain way to other people? Like that propaganda of their personal connection?
No, that wasn't what I thought. I was thinking more along the lines of that you know, either she was trying to give him a message so that he would, like, maybe get over Nina or something, you know, propaganda, maybe that Nina was propagandizing him, or that the center was, you know, putting him in romantic situations and trying to encourage things. I don't know. Or that maybe she has her own agenda that hasn't been revealed yet, and propaganda is a part of it.
Well, Oleg's a good-looking dude. He's a pretty loyal Russian, and he's connected to a pretty wealthy family. So he would be a pretty good catch, I think, for...
Yeah.
And he's smart, and he seems pretty cool. I mean, he'd be a pretty good catch.
Yeah.
All right, Zenaida's still pounding the Milky Way bars, Jamie. Stan's giving her the media schedule.
Now, I kept thinking,
are they a potential unit?
No, they're not. No. Who's interested? God, no. Well,
why not?
Okay, well, first of all, she's starving. You can't have people just, like, every time you see them, they're chewing on something, be, you know, sexually appealing in terms of the storyline. You just can't. Okay, so that's number one. Number two is that I just don't think that's her place. I mean, they've made her sort of matronly and sort of homely and, you know, kind of, she's very much about her very direct. We were talking about Maslow's hierarchy earlier. She's very much about getting her direct needs met right now. She needs shelter. She needs food. She needs to be safe.
Right, but she's been there now for a little while. She doesn't need that Milky Way. She's just in love with him. That's not her second Milky Way 5 minutes after she gets out of the box. She's been there a couple days now.
I'm sorry. I don't know, then. I don't know.
All right. Well, she wants Stan to help her work off. She wants him to give her some exercise. She wants to see D.C. She wants to go around and see the sights, right?
But that's
she
right.
Can't because it's too dangerous.
Right.
And I don't think we realized. I didn't really realize. And maybe she didn't in the show, that she's really still in danger. She hasn't reached absolute freedom and peacefulness here in America. She's under a threat of a few different people.
Right.
And Stan tells her this.
Right. Well, yeah. I mean, and he, you know, he tried to soften it because, you know, in actuality, what they said in the episode before this is that Russia is going to send a message. They're going to want to send a message that just because she's here doesn't mean she's safe. And so she is really under immediate danger. And that's why Stan was so insistent that they get her a hotel room that had no adjoining rooms. You know, like, they are really concerned about her safety, but they can't let her know that her life is really in danger. And so she doesn't have a clue. She says, you know, oh, would they really come after me here in America? And I was just shaking my head thinking, well, heck yeah, lady. I mean, this is when they really want to get you is here.
Well, she knows now, though, right? Stan tells her, you're not necessarily safe. He won't walk her around to where she wants to go. He kind of tells her it's not safe to do that simple thing you wanted to do.
Right. He breaks it to her gently, and to me, there's not enough warning there, and it's making me kind of wonder if she's not going to try to step out on her own, sort of dismiss the overprotectiveness of the FBI and, you know, step out there and go see some sights because she's bored.
I'm putting her and Stan together, and I'm putting Oleg and Tatiana together.
Oh, no. No, it's going to be, I was thinking about this. You're a genius and you don't know it. The other day when you predicted that it would be Stan and
Martha.
Martha, you were right. Okay. And here's why. If it's Stan and Martha, this is how, like, Martha actually realizes that Philip is not Clark, because she's going to be involved with Stan. Stan's going to be doing his pillow talk. She's going to either see a picture of Philip and Stan together with Philip looking like Philip and not looking like Clark, or he's going to be telling her stories about his good old friend and buddy, or something is going to happen where she's sleeping with these two guys who are best friends. she's going to figure something out, and that's where that gun is going to come into play. So I think you're a genius, and I think that's the romantic connection that's going to happen with, for Stan.
It's pretty interesting how women, like girls and women, like to take lots of pictures and stuff, especially if you're married to someone, right?
Right.
And she has no pictures of her and Philip on the bedstand or anything. Not that I know of, but that would be that theory would be a good one if that was true, if Stan ended up over there and saw Philip's picture or something.
Yeah, that would be really interesting, because that's not what I was thinking. But imagine that, because that could like break this whole thing wide open.
All right. So Oleg's father goes to see Nina in the Moscow prison. He's a big shot in the government. He's the minister of railways. And he's trying to understand Oleg's preoccupation with Nina. And he sees right away that she's really attractive. I think that's what he means by, like, I see why Oleg was connected to you, right? That was the physical?
I think it may have been not only the physical, but the actual presence that she bears. Like, the, you know, her presence, her personality, the way that she seems.
Calm and cool.
She's a very intense person. She's a quiet but intense person. And she's very no nonsense.
He may have been watching or listening into some of those secret recordings too that you made me aware of with the wire in the cell too.
Maybe.
But he says here's another counterpoint that I thought was cool. He says, "No children is a blessing. We're always trying to do what's best for them." And that's directly related to Philip and Elizabeth with Paige, right? Trying to do what's best, and now he's trying to do what's best with Oleg.
Right. Yeah.
And he reveals to her that he wanted me to save you. Oleg wanted me to save you, or wants me to save you.
Right.
And Nina says, "Tell him I wasn't pretending."
Yes. And that sort of brings us back to the thought that we were sharing about Nina. We talked about how Nina and Oleg seemed to have a kind of closeness that wasn't there between Nina and Stan, and a kind of sincerity that wasn't there. And I think we were saying that their feelings seemed to be deeper. I thought that their feelings were more real. They seemed more real than what she had with Stan. And now it kind of seems like maybe that was really what was intended by the writers.
Could be.
Yeah.
It's interesting in this very last scene that they, with Philip and Elizabeth at the travel agency, they get to like kind of the punchline, I think, of Paige, because they left us last episode really wondering about Paige. And here they really, for the first time in this episode, talk directly about Paige. They say the Paige problem is not going to go away. And then Elizabeth tells her story to Philip, which I guess must have been the first time, because it sounded like the first time. That when they came to me, I needed to decide. I was 16 as a girl, and I told my mother I didn't know what to do. And she told me to serve my country. And she did. When she was called, she had to go. She really kind of was influenced pretty heavily, I think, by her mother.
Right. And that's the thing. That was the missing piece that kind of put a human face on the way that Elizabeth is approaching this, because it seems completely heartless. It seems counter to any parent's love for their child to put them into a life where they have to live a lie. And I mean a real deep, serious lie. And you know, no one, there was no way for me to understand that. And the way that Elizabeth explained it, and that just that little tiny story that she told, really one sentence. "When I went to my mother and told her that I was being recruited, she didn't hesitate. She told me to go and serve my country." And that was just such a meaningful, simple thing that Elizabeth said. And it said it all.
Is Philip being persuaded here? Philip doesn't have an answer. This ends with him just being silent.
Right, but he's got tears in his eyes.
So is he being swayed over to her side?
I don't know if he's being swayed, but I know that he now understands.
Pretty powerful way to end it. It made me think he's being persuaded.
I agree with you. I think that I don't know that he's being persuaded, but for me, even for me, because there's nobody in the audience that's more opposed to the idea of putting your child in danger that way than me. Like, I'm completely on Philip's side in this thing. I don't want for this to add, I mean, not, and I'm talking about from a personal philosophical standpoint, not from an audience, you know, fan standpoint. I would not want Paige to be recruited if she were my child. And so I'm with Philip on this. But after that story that Elizabeth told, I kind of get it.
All right, Jamie. So we got a couple spoiler comments. So in between then and now, let's tell people about how to reach us. So if anyone in that audience wanted to tell you or argue with you about how to manage your child, how would they reach you on Twitter?
It would be @WordGirly.
Okay, and my Twitter handle is @scathingtweets, and our website is West Coast Project, and The Americans is one of the podcasts on West Coast Project. It'd be really helpful if you like our podcast and you listen to us on iTunes or Stitcher to leave a comment, or at the very least a rating on iTunes. That helps us move up the status on iTunes. More people can find us and see us. And for spoilers, did you catch anything from the previews for next episode, Jamie, that you wanted to comment on?
No, I don't ever watch those. And so if you want to share them with me, I will give you my real life first person reaction now.
All right. Well, you could hang up so you won't be spoiled, but then I'd be just talking to myself. But we hear Stan say the CIA wants to see where it leads. They got her surrounded. I don't know who he was saying it to, and I'm pretty sure it was Stan saying it. So the CIA wants to see where it leads, and they've got her surrounded, I think, is what I heard. We hear Gabriel talking to Paige, I think, and he says to her, "Paige, we all have a choice."
Wow.
We see Philip talking to Gabriel, and he tells Gabriel she's only 14 years old.
Huh.
And then we hear Paige. Paige says, "I wish you guys would stop worrying about it."
Huh. Well, I guess Paige gets the new reality next episode.
Now, they manipulate these sometimes, and they punch in a bunch of scenes that we've already seen to make it look like we're seeing a lot of action and stuff, but it's really stuff that we've already seen. So some of these can be misleading sometimes. But there's a couple interesting comments there. And I guess there was one other one. Stan and the guy, whoever was Gad's partner that was with him the night he got punched.
Uh-huh.
That guy who got punched, who hurt his arm, the other guy, not Gad, who hurt his arm, says to Gad, "Put her over now before it's too late." So I don't know who they mean. Maybe this Canadian embassy woman?
Huh. I don't know.
But that's it.
Well, I guess, I have to tell you, this is a much better tease than the one that we had last week. That one left me sleepless and worried. So this one's better.
Well, then you found out you had nothing to worry about.
That's right.
Maybe this benign one is really more dangerous than you think.
Oh, no.
All right, Jamie. So until next time, do you happen to know the episode next time?
It looks like it's Open House.
Okay. All right, Jamie. So until next episode, Open House, that's it for our coverage of 302 Baggage on The Americans.
All right, cool.